Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, October the 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Hurricane Matthew leaves devastation in its wake as it heads toward the U.S.
We've been through winter storms. We've been through a thousand-year flood. A hurricane is different.
Presidential candidates preparing for Sunday's second debate, a crowdsourcing effort to support breast cancer research. And also ahead, we talk to Entertainment Tonight for an update on the Kim Kardashian robbery. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, rescue workers are struggling to reach isolated towns on Haiti's southern peninsula to learn the full extent of destruction caused by Hurricane Matthew. The storm dumped more than 60 centimeters of rain there and is already being called the worst humanitarian crisis to hit the nation since a 2010 earthquake killed more than 200,000 people there. Many of them were still living in tents and makeshift dwellings when the storm hit on Tuesday. At least 16 deaths have been blamed on the hurricane, 10 of them in Haiti. But with a key bridge washed out, roads impassable, and phone communications down, the western tip of Haiti has been largely cut off. So it's still too hard to have a full accounting of what has happened. And the lack of access and communication is hampering relief efforts. The humanitarian agency World Vision has hundreds of staff members in the country. Drew Clark is a spokesman.
Flash flooding is one of the biggest concerns in a hurricane in terms of loss of life, because flash flooding can suddenly take away buildings and drown people. It can also contribute to landslides, which are a major threat in Haiti because there's a lot of eroded hillsides in Haiti that are very prone to landslides. After a severe disaster like this, the focus of the first 24 hours is often on search and rescue operations. People want to know their family and friends are okay. But the focus quickly shifts to basic supply provision for people who have been displaced out of their homes. So that means getting basic items like blankets and tarps to sleep under if they're not able to access shelters, as well as water purification tablets if the water supplies have been compromised, and hygiene kits, cooking kits, just basic items.
Well, after moving past Haiti, Matthew rolled across a corner of Cuba, then began pounding the southern Bahamas with heavy wind and rain. Now, forecasters say the storm could hit the U.S. state of Florida or come dangerously close Thursday evening and then sideswipe the East Coast all the way up to the Carolinas over the weekend. President Obama spoke on Wednesday after meeting with officials at the Office of Emergency Management in Washington.
I want to emphasize to the public, this is a serious storm. It has already hit Haiti with devastating effect. It is now in the process of moving through the Bahamas. Because it's not going to be hitting enough land, it is going to be building strength on its way to Florida. We anticipate that by tomorrow morning, it will already begin to have significant effect in Florida and then has the potential to strengthen and move on up the coast during the course of the day.
Nearly 2 million people along the lower East Coast have been urged to evacuate their homes. Here's Florida Governor Rick Scott.
Multiple people have already been killed by this major storm. We do not want to see another life lost. If Matthew directly impacts Florida, there will be massive destruction that we haven't seen in years. This is a deadly storm approaching our coast. I cannot stress that enough.
Well, as people boarded up their homes in Florida, state officials say about 1.5 million people are being encouraged to clear out. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Greece will begin schooling migrant children. The U.S. Supreme Court is poised to back Texas death row inmate. The Rolling Stones are expected to announce their first studio album in a decade. And a Paris Agreement on climate change will take effect November 4th. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues now with the big moment for their running mates behind them. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are shifting their focus back to each other and to this coming Sunday's debate. That's the second of three showdowns between the two candidates. Clinton has been deep in debate prep at her Washington, D.C. home, huddling with her top advisors, while Donald Trump spent the day campaigning in the state of Nevada. Taking the stage in Henderson, Nevada, he talked about how he'll view a loss in this election.
One of the very big pundits, very respected, actually very liberal, said, you know, what you've done has never been done before. And it makes no difference if you win or lose this movement, it will go down in history. I said, no, you don't understand. I'd like to agree with you. But if I don't win, this will be the greatest waste of time, money, and energy in my lifetime by a factor of 100.
Well, Trump also showered praise on his running mate Mike Pence's performance in Tuesday night's vice presidential debate. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the debate between Trump's running mate Mike Pence and Clinton's running mate Tim Kaine.
Pence and Kaine clashed over foreign policy, with Pence alleging that the U.S. has grown weaker under the leadership of President Barack Obama.
After traveling millions of miles as our Secretary of State, after being the architect of the foreign policy of this administration, America is less safe today.
For his part, Kaine took aim at some of Trump's foreign policy proposals, including on nuclear policy.
Donald Trump believes that the world will be safer if more nations have nuclear weapons. He said Saudi Arabia should get them, Japan should get them, Korea should get them.
Historically, vice presidential debates have had little impact on the outcome of presidential elections, and the second Clinton-Trump debate comes in only 5 days. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And by the way, VOA will have live coverage of the entire town hall-style debate on Sunday night. Well, turning now to social media and what's been trending, I'm joined by G. Abby Lee. G, I imagine there's been lots of talk about the vice presidential debate. Who are people saying won it?
So isn't that the money question that everyone wants to know? And Twitter Moments actually posted the same question. Its users put Republican VP candidate Mike Pence as a winner at 54%. That means his Democratic counterpart received 46% of the Twitter votes. Some critics gave a clear victory to Pence, but many Democrats said his running mate Donald Trump was the ultimate loser, noting that Pence made policy remarks that are contradicting Trump's. But Lori, perhaps this is the most important tweet. It's from 538. VP debates don't move the polls much, even when they're pretty good debates. So all this to no avail. 538 is a website that focuses on opinion poll analysis and other numbers-related blogging. It's created by Nate Silver, a well-known statistician here in America.
Right. That seems to be the talk that no matter how a person does it, it's not going to really make much of a difference. What did the presidential candidates tweet about the debate?
It seems like both of the candidates are pretty happy. So Donald Trump tweeted, "Mike Pence won big. We should all be proud of Mike." And Clinton wrote this, "Lucky to have a partner like Tim Kaine who stood up for our shared vision tonight instead of trying to deny it." So there's a little dig at Mike Pence there.
Yeah, I also heard Donald Trump was almost taking credit for picking Mike Pence, saying, well, this was my first big hire, and so I deserve credit for that. But so what else is trending?
So if you're a fan of either Natalie Portman or Jackie Kennedy, this is a great news for you. I happen to be a fan of both of them, and Twitter users are using hashtag Jackie to talk about a new movie starring the American actress as a late first lady. Judging by the tweets by the people who have already watched it at the Toronto International Film Festival, Portman may have locked up another Oscar with this one.
Wow.
That's all for me today.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. Well, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month in the United States, and once a week for the entire month, we'll be featuring a story on the subject. Today, we're focusing on a unique program. Tens of thousands of women in the United States afflicted with an aggressive form of breast cancer have joined together to help cure the disease. They're part of a clinical trial that's looking for clues that could lead to earlier treatment. VOA's Kevin Enochs reports.
So my box showed up for my sample.
LaTanya Wilson has metastatic breast cancer, which means it has spread to other parts of her body. But she is fighting back against this virulent form of the disease, along with over 2,000 other women who have volunteered to be part of the Metastatic Breast Cancer Project.
You know, everybody hollers about, we need a cure, we need a cure. The only way to actually find a cure is to participate in clinical trials. You know, the doctors and the scientists, they can do but so much, but they need people to participate.
The project is run out of the Broad Institute at MIT and Harvard, where saliva and tumor samples from patients like Wilson are processed into a giant database. It's a new way to conduct research.
So this is different than how most studies are run, which usually are run at large cancer centers and large institutions where the enrollment has to happen through their doctor. This is a way for patients to take participation in research into their own hands.
So far, the project has discovered small groups of patients who respond unusually well to standard chemotherapy or to new immunotherapy drugs. The hope is that DNA analysis will explain why some patients live up to 10 years when the average survival rate is about 3 years. Wilson understands she may not see a treatment breakthrough in her lifetime.
So once it's found, I can say, I helped. I helped by providing my medical information. I helped by trying to get other people to participate in this. I helped just by, you know, providing all the information they need for them to be able to do it. So even though something small, I helped.
Kevin Enochs, VOA News, Washington.
Well, here's a concept. Try a little kindness. Maybe a lot of the world's problems could actually be solved. A New York woman is hoping to help that idea along. Joining me now, Jacqueline Lindsay, the co-founder and CEO of the new nonprofit, kindness.org. Thanks for being with us, Jacqueline. What exactly is your goal with this project?
Our mission is trying to empower people around the world from all walks of life to choose kindness. To basically put kindness at the forefront of human interaction. And we're doing that by blending technology, action, and research.
And how exactly are you going about that?
So I think in the beginning, we started trying to understand, how does kindness create change? And does it actually create change? I think we needed to know what happens when people extend kindness, and also how we hope to achieve it. And we knew that in order to really get to scale, we needed to do something online. However, kindness is person to person. So what we did was we built a platform that allowed people to have their own voice of kindness. No matter where they lived, they could say what kindness meant to them and invite people to take a specific action of that kindness. So for example, if someone said, I'm really passionate about the environment and I want people to pick up litter, no matter where you are in the world, you could participate by picking up litter and join this, we're calling them initiative creators, join this initiative and join this creator in that kind act. However, I think the important thing, Lori, for us was that what we did online did have limitations. And if we say that we care about all people being able to be involved in this mission, we needed to figure out how we could get people to be able to participate who might not have access to a computer or who might not be able to participate online. And so we're also doing physical spaces and working with people living in social isolation to come in to these physical spaces and receive kindness and to have stigma removed from them.
When you say people living in isolation, can you give us some examples of who might be benefiting?
It's primarily people who are experiencing homelessness, domestic violence, people who are formerly incarcerated or experiencing mental illness. You know, what happens often is those people are labeled. But what if we could have a space where that stigma was removed and you were just a person? You were able to walk in, be a member of society, not this label that seems to often have a negative connotation to it, but you could just come in and experience kindness and connection, friends, and purpose with people.
How did you come up with this whole concept?
I was on a soul searching journey last year. I've always been in the nonprofit space and have had a passion for people and have cared a lot about our world. I've also been passionate about breaking down barriers of judgment, that when we meet people, we're so quick to make a decision about them. And I wanted to figure out if I could go beyond that. I had no idea what it looked like, but I took some time to think about what really mattered to me and how would this manifest. And I landed on this kind of mission statement for myself. In big letters in my journal, I wrote, I want to inspire kindness and generosity. So I decided to quit my job, which was an amazing job, and a lot of people gave me shocking reactions.
Right. You're going to quit your job and seek kindness in the world.
Yep. And to be honest, Lori, as I started talking to people, I found out there were a lot of people who were passionate about this.
Hmm.
And it's been almost a year. I started working October 1st on this idea. And the amount of people who have come across the path to help make this a reality, it's humbling. And I think it just is indicative that it's a real need and people are wanting more kindness in the world today.
Apparently, there are some new studies coming out from the University of Oxford that actually prove that case.
Very much so. You know, kindness is nebulous, or it can be perceived as ambiguous. And out of the gate, we knew we wanted to cement ourselves as an evidence-based organization, that what we were building, yes, it's people to people, but could we root ourselves in science? And that's why one of our pillars and kind of strategic goals is this investment into impact and research and demonstrating the role kindness can play. And so we're really proud to say that the first study that we've commissioned was conducted by Oxford University, and we'll be releasing that paper very soon. And we really wanted to understand the landscape of kindness. How many times have we all seen articles, heard stories that kindness will make you happy? There's hundreds of articles out there that speak to this.
Mm-hmm.
And so Oxford went in and basically did a systematic literature review. They went and did a deep dive. They looked at more than 375 articles trying to understand the effects of kindness and analyzing those studies so that we could have a benchmark of how we move kindness forward. And basically what it showed is we need more research, that there's a strong baseline that yes, kindness does have an effect on your happiness and well-being, but we're really excited because we think we're now paving the way of how we move kindness research forward to see real impact and real change.
All right, Jacqueline Lindsay, co-founder and CEO of the just-launched nonprofit kindness.org. You're listening to International Edition.
On November 8th, American voters will choose their next president. We'll provide you with the latest updates. Will it be Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? Will third-party candidates like Gary Johnson or Jill Stein have an impact on the final outcome? What does that mean for Americans and the world? It's all here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Taylor Swift planning a big concert ahead of another big event in the U.S., but first, French police continue to hunt for five people suspected in the assault and robbery of $10 million worth of jewelry from reality star Kim Kardashian West in a private Paris residence early Monday. After forcing their way into her apartment, the robbers held her up at gunpoint and locked her in a bathroom before escaping on bicycles. Joining me now is Entertainment Tonight senior news editor Jennifer Peros. Hi, Jen. What's the latest on this?
this story seems to be getting crazier and crazier as days go by and more information comes out. So, you know, what we do know right now is that Kim is still in New York City as of Wednesday afternoon with two of her children and Kanye West. So she's been here since Monday morning, since getting back from Paris. And some new information that's coming out today is about the concierge guy. You know, for the past 2 days, everyone was focused on Kim and what happened with her. But now we're getting some more details about who let these five masks robbers into her apartment. And it was this, you know, French guy who was working at the front desk at this apartment building. And robbers had come in and had put a gun to his head, threatened to kill him if he didn't let them up into Kim's apartment. And the guy, handcuffed, walked them up. And he was actually in the apartment the entire time that they were robbing. It was him and Kim pretty much crying and standing together. And Kim, you know, from what we're hearing from sources, Kim had looked at the guy and asked him, "Do you think we're going to die?" And he just stood there and said, "You know, I don't know." It's pretty scary. And, you know, what we do know now is that Kim, of course, is cooperating with French authorities. She was on the phone with them for a pretty long time, telling them what she remembers and giving them some more details about her night. But it's really, really scary. And I don't think it comes as a surprise. We haven't heard from any of the members of the family on social media. You know, this family is well known for tweeting and Instagramming and Snapchatting everything, but they haven't been since Sunday. I mean, the only person in the family who actually has addressed the issue is Caitlyn Jenner, and she had posted a picture of Kim on her Instagram yesterday saying, you know, she's so thankful she's okay and her thoughts are with her. It's going to be interesting to see if this entire incident makes them realize that they probably should be staying a little bit more private on their social media accounts.
Plus, you know, that's an awful lot of jewelry to be having in a hotel room, millions of dollars worth.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I mean, you have to think, you know, from what we know, 6 to 8 pieces of jewelry were taken. Mm-hmm. It's not that many. I know it's a large sum of money. Mm-hmm. You know, her engagement ring alone is almost $5 million. So, you know, a lot of people are hearing, you know, the $10 million worth of jewelry. That was about 6 pieces.
Did they take her engagement ring?
They did, yeah. You know, Kanye actually gave her a brand new ring this summer, and they did take that, yeah.
And do they have any idea? Do they think this was an inside job?
People in the family and sources close to Kim, yeah, they do think it's an inside job. I mean, there's only 2 5-hour windows that Kim was alone in Paris without her security guard. Her security guard never stays in her room with her to begin with. You know, even if he was in the building, he may not have been able to stop this. But there's only 2 5-hour windows that Kim was alone, and that was both to go to sleep. So, you know, sources are saying it must have been somebody who knew her schedule or knew that she was back in the apartment and alone.
All right. Entertainment Tonight senior news editor Jennifer Peros. You can see the full story at etonline.com. Well, the Super Bowl is a very big event here in the U.S., and not just because of the football game. There are usually huge celebrities performing during halftime, and this year it will be Lady Gaga. But we're also learning that Grammy-winning superstar Taylor Swift will be headlining a concert in Houston, Texas, the night before the Super Bowl championship in February. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the show, which in recent years has featured such stars as Katy Perry, Justin Timberlake, Jay-Z, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
And this will be the Saturday night event. So this will be the night before the Super Bowl. Of course, Super Bowl is the big football game that happens sort of like the football finals here in the U.S. But the halftime show generally attracts about 100 million viewers. So it's a huge get for any artist. And Taylor Swift has said in the past that she's always wanted to do the Super Bowl halftime show, but she has a major endorsement deal with Diet Coke, which is in direct competition with Pepsi, who sponsors the Super Bowl halftime show.
The Pepsi halftime show.
Exactly. So yeah. She was never able to do it. So she signed a multi-million dollar deal with AT&T, who will be essentially paying for this massive concert and a variety of other events. And my understanding is that there are also going to be some other programming around this concert. So this has the potential to maybe not be as big, but certainly huge for Taylor Swift in that weekend. And it's also, I think, an interesting deal because she, like Rihanna in the past with Samsung, like Drake in the past with Apple, is signing up with a telecom company. And we could at some point maybe see, hear music from Taylor being released on an AT&T platform. So lover, hater, you've got to respect her hustle.
And, you know, the thing is, the Super Saturday Night is what this thing is called. This is quite a lexicon of people, or pantheon, I guess, is a better way of putting it, of people. Katy Perry, Justin Timberlake, Jay-Z, Kanye West, Red Hot Chili Peppers have all done this Saturday Night show.
Right.
It's not the halftime show, but it's the next best thing. And if the NFL is smart, they're going to have some way of fans at home with their flat screen being able to dial up and see this.
Yeah, I'm almost certain that it will be live streamed at some point. So it needs to be. And if it is, of course, on VOA1, we'll have clips from it for you on our social media platforms so that you can get a taste of Taylor Swift. Now, Taylor Swift has been on tour. She was on tour all last year. She knows how to work a stage. She's home here. So I think that she'll put on a great show. And it'll be interesting to see what she does in juxtaposition with Lady Gaga, who we also know can put on a great show and is going to have some guest appearances with her during her halftime show. And there's a lot of speculation about who and how and why and how big, really.
The mystery continues.
Well, I'm thinking Elton John. I just have to say that. I'm going to put it out there now. I think Elton John is going to make an appearance at the halftime show.
We have one vote for Elton John. I'll vote for Tony Bennett. That's right. Because they did The Lady is a Tramp, great version.
Yes.
Shauna Renee, thank you so much. Are you a Swiftie? Are you a fan of Taylor Swift? Are you looking forward to this big concert? Have you maybe been to one of her shows during her world tour? Let us know. You can hit us up on Twitter. Shauna is at VOA Lady DJ. And you can find the Soul Lounge, that's Shauna's show, on our website, voanews.com.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of International Edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb. I'm Lori London in Washington. Make it a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gender equality has powerful potential to improve the economy, security, and the overall well-being of a population. If the world closed the gender gap in workforce participation, global gross domestic product would increase by $28 trillion by 2025. That's about a quarter of the world's current GDP and almost half of the world's current debt, said U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Women's Issues, Catherine Russell, in a recent speech. She also noted that studies have found that countries with less gender inequality are more secure and peace agreements last longer when women are at the negotiating table. Nonetheless, no country in the world can boast that it has achieved full gender equality. Around the world, women are vastly underrepresented in politics and the workforce, particularly in leadership positions and other high-paying jobs, said Ambassador Russell. At the same time, women make up the bulk of the poor. I've heard people say that poverty has a female face, and that makes sense when you consider that women control just one-fifth of global wealth, said Ambassador Russell. World leaders are beginning to recognize that everyone benefits from advancing gender equality, she said. This is why gender equality is part of U.S. foreign policy. A key part of U.S. efforts focus on educating and empowering girls. In the past 18 months, the United States launched its global strategy to empower adolescent girls, as well as Let Girls Learn, which is a presidential initiative that focuses on educating girls. We are also working with numerous countries to dismantle barriers that keep women from inheriting or owning property, entering the formal job market, or accessing banking services. Gender equality sometimes looks like an impossible task, a pursuit without an end, said Ambassador Russell. But we can make progress, and that progress is worth making. Little by little, discussion by discussion, step by step, we can improve the lives of women and girls, men and boys, all around the world. And in doing so, we can reach our shared goals of peace, prosperity, and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For what's the universe?